Good morning and greetings to each one of you this morning. Thank you for your prayers and please continue to keep praying. I am in myself feel empty, but I know God's word is full and it has answers for us, and I trust that there will be something there for each of us this morning. I'd be curious to know how each of you feel here at this point in time of the fiscal year. Seasons come, seasons go. This is August. Summer is coming to a close. School terms are about to begin. And there's a lot going, a lot on us. And for myself, I feel tired. And as we go from day to day, week to week, it just seems like there's no stopping. The schedules are full, the calls are there to be answered, and we keep pressing on. And this week I was talking with the one forester that showed up to the job, and it was interesting. He just, of his own, he's a talker, and he was talking about life and all the things him and his wife and family are facing, and he said, when it rains, it pours, he said. It just seems like there's no end to it. And maybe that's the way you feel this morning. If it is, then, we're going to take you to Matthew chapter 11. Some familiar words here that we're going to base the message on. Matthew chapter 11, drop down to the end of the chapter, verse 28 through 30. Come unto me, all ye that labor and are heavy laden, and I will give you rest. Take my yoke upon you and learn of me, for I am meek and lowly in heart, and ye shall find rest unto your souls. For my yoke is easy and my burden is light. Message title for this morning is Rest for the Heavy Laden. I also, as I was studying, was debating whether I should call it The Heavy Laden Finding Rest. There's a difference between standing here this morning and discussing rest, types of rest, and where to find rest, or should our focus be on the finding part? Should we focus more on the heavy laden finding rest rather than just discussing rest for the heavy laden? You know, there could be all the rest that we need provided for us. God could have it all there in front of us, but if we don't find it, what good is it? And it's like it's already been said that you can lead a horse to the water, but you can't force the horse to drink. And the horse could be standing there and there's hundreds or thousands of gallons of water in front of it, but if the horse refuses to drink, it will eventually die. And this morning, if you're heavy laden and you want rest but you refuse to find it or to go the whole way in finding it, death will overtake you. It will slowly but surely starve out of existence. Well, we could ask the question, what are we heavy laden with? And this would probably really vary, but there's so much, I think, that we could discuss. There's expectations that go unmet. There's financial demands that are levied against us. There's back sets. There's accidents. There's relationships that fall apart. There's crying children, there's discouraged youth, there's exhausted adults, there's inconsistent Christians, there's scorning apostates, there's taunting unbelievers, there's trauma, disagreements, miscommunication. There's false accusations. There's anger. There's deceit. There's fear. There's lust. There's toil. This is a little bit of an idea of what we're thinking of when we're thinking about being heavy laden, the burdens that are upon us. And it's a little bit the picture I get when I read in Romans where Paul says that the whole world, the whole earth is groaning and travailing. And Paul says in that, in those verses, you see that he's talking of the unbelievers. He says, and not only they, but ourselves also. And so just because we know Christ here this morning does not mean we're exempt from the burdens that the curse has brought upon us. And so I'd like to look at the message this morning in just four simple points. The first point would be come. Second, take. The third, find. I'm sorry. First, I have come. The second, take. The third, I have learn. And then finally, we'll look at find and notice some different types of rest. Jesus here in verse 28 says, come unto me, all ye that labor and are heavy laden. This is an invitation that he's extending to everyone. And I don't believe there's a single soul that could make the argument that he is not invited, he is not, there is an exception for him. This is an invitation for everyone. But coming to Christ necessitates leaving behind ourselves. We won't come to Christ and, or I should say, we can't come to Christ and drag ourselves along, bring our own baggage along. To accept this invitation to come is to let behind ourselves. We have to come and let it come out of ourselves and into Christ. Out of my bondage, sorrow and night, Jesus I come, Jesus I come. Into thy freedom, gladness and light, Jesus I come to thee. Out of my sickness, into thy health, out of my want and into thy wealth. Out of my sin and into thyself, Jesus I come to thee. Out of my shameful failure and loss, Jesus I come, Jesus I come. Into the glorious gain of thy cross, Jesus I come to thee. Out of our sorrows into thy balm, out of life's storms and into thy calm. Out of distress to jubilant psalm, Jesus I come to thee. Out of unrest and arrogant pride, Jesus I come, Jesus I come. Into thy blessed will to abide, Jesus, I come to thee. Out of myself to dwell in thy love, out of despair into raptures above, upward for aye on wings like a dove, Jesus, I come to thee. Out of the fear and dread of the tomb, Jesus, I come, Jesus, I come. Into the joy and light of thy home, Jesus, I come to thee. Out of the depths of ruin untold, into the peace of thy sheltering fold, ever thy glorious face to behold, Jesus, I come to thee. I'd like you to turn back to Luke chapter 14. We're going to read a few verses. So Jesus is saying, come, and there's a need for us to let behind ourselves and our own burdens. Luke 14, we have some excuses, or we could call them hindrances to coming to Christ, given. I'd like to read a few verses here in Luke 14. We're going to read verse 15 through 21. Luke 14, 15. And when one of them that sat at meat with him heard these things, he said unto him, blessed is he that shall eat bread in the kingdom of God. Then said he unto him, a certain man made a great supper and bade many, and sent his servant at supper time to say to them that were bidden, come, for all things are now ready. And they all with one accord began to make excuse. The first said unto him, I have bought a piece of ground, and I must needs go and see it. I pray thee have me excused. And another said, I have bought 5 yoke of oxen, and I go to prove them. I pray thee have me excused. And another said, I have married a wife, and therefore I cannot come. So that servant came and showed his lord these things. And the master of the house, being angry, said to his servant, Go out quickly into the streets and lanes of the city, and bring in hither the poor, and the maimed, and the halt, and the blind. And the servant said, Lord, it is done as thou hast commanded, and yet there is room. And the Lord said unto the servant, Go out into the highways and hedges, and compel them to come in, that my house may be filled. For I say unto you, that none of those men which were bidden shall taste of my supper. Jesus here likens the kingdom of God to this certain man who made a great supper. And again, the invitation was, Come, all things are now ready, and you're invited to come and partake. But in the first few verses, we have the guests that were invited beginning to make excuses for why they wish to be absent. The first excuse or the first hindrance that we see was in verse 18. The first man says, I've bought a piece of ground. I'm just going to have to go see it. And I would label this as the hindrance of fortune or wealth or riches or whatever else you want to put in there. But this man had just bought some ground, and his interest was in going to see that ground, to take possession of it, rather than coming to the supper. He was a landholder, and it seems like he thought he could buy his way to self-sufficiency and rest. By his own wealth and status quo, he didn't see this host as having anything to offer him. The accumulation of wealth and goods denies us the privilege of laying it all aside, coming to Jesus, and finding rest. There's something within us as men, I think, that drives us to believe that rest can be found in more things. If we only had a little bit more, or if we only got a little bit bigger, somehow there's rest just around the corner. And maybe we pursue that at the expense of coming to the supper. If we pursue fortune, it makes it impossible to come to this supper, and we have just canceled our prescription for rest that Jesus is promising. In verse 19, we have another man. This man's excuse for not coming to Christ was, I've just bought 5 yoke of oxen, and I have to go prove them. And I would say this man used industry as an excuse for not coming to the supper. And today we deal with industry as well, and it has its own temptations for us. He says, I go to prove them. How ironic was it that he turned down an invitation for something eternally sustaining to bet his existence on something that still needed to be proven. Burying ourselves in industry will never buy soul rest. Jesus says you need to come out of it. You need to come out of your fixation with it. You need to leave it behind in your priorities. Make sure you don't miss the supper. And I believe that the rest you find around this table will more than compensate for whatever caliber of oxen are in your stable. The third man in this story says, I've married a wife, and so I cannot come. This man allowed human relationships to hinder him from attending the supper. Now, God has created us with the need for companionship and for human relationships. But we can, as human beings, we can seek rest in human relationships that we can't find outside of Christ. Seeking rest in human relationships cannot equal what you'll find in Christ. Marrying is not the answer to all life's problems, and it's certainly not the avenue for finding true soul rest. And this man traded an eternal invitation for an earthly relationship. Paul in 1 Corinthians 7, he's speaking of the married and unmarried, and he says that the unmarried are, they're free. They're able to focus on what really matters. And these married men over here, he said, they struggle. They need to seek how to please their wife, and it's just rather hard for them to keep their priorities right. But he did go on to admit that marriage is good and honorable. But if you're married, make sure your spouse is not the kind that's going to keep you from attending the supper. Another hindrance to coming to Christ, I would see in these verses, is the social groupings. If you compare verse 18, at the beginning of verse 18, it says, "And they all with one consent began to make excuse." And if you drop down to verse 21, we have the poor, the maimed, the halt, and the blind all coming to the supper. And I'm sure it would have depended on which group you were in, but if you would have been in the group of these higher class men, you could have said that no one's going to the supper. And you probably would have been right, at least with what you were observing. But if you would have been out in the streets, if you would have been sitting with the poor, if you would have been out sitting beside the beggar or the blind man, you would have been saying, everybody's going. And so our social groupings, our cliques, our the little groups we form among ourselves, make sure it's not a hindrance to you and coming to the supper that God is providing. Make sure it's not a hindrance to accepting the invitation to come. In the second part of the message, I'd like to look at Jesus' word here. He says, "Take my yoke upon you." And you can say, a yoke? What, that doesn't sound like rest to me. And I would suggest that this is probably one of the great paradoxes of Christian experience, and that is that we find rest through labor, not from it. And yes, that's what Jesus is saying. Take my yoke upon you. We find rest through labor, not from labor. And here in Matthew 11, Jesus uses this, the yoke example, and it's a metaphoric illustration of linking two oxen together. And we can picture that neck yoke, or the bow yoke that goes around their necks and joins them together. This is the typology that Jesus is portraying, rather than, if you remember, maybe in the Laura Ingalls books, when Paul and his father would go out to gather maple syrup, they would wear what they called a neck yoke, and it would come around their neck, and it would allow them to carry a burden that was equally balanced on their shoulders around their neck. That's not the type of yoke Jesus is speaking of. He's illustrating this truth with the illustration of a bow yoke, and oftentimes in a yoke setup, you would have a lead animal in that yoke. This was especially beneficial if you were working a younger or untrained animal. And the older, the well-seasoned horse or ox would help to guide the inexperienced one. It would help to set the pace. So we're thinking about us in a yoke with Christ. The strong-willed animals don't work well together. They have a tendency to pull at different speeds and in different directions, and it just creates tension. But if you have a lead animal, you're often able to maintain a steady, coordinated pull. And I think this well illustrates the truth that Jesus is projecting here in Matthew 11. It's he, the lead, and us as the follower in a yoke. And it works very well. But the objections start coming, and you say, well, isn't the Christian experience to be free and liberating, not bondage, not tied to a yoke? But I'd like you to consider that here in Matthew 11, consider the spiritual nature of this yoke. It's definitely not a physical yoke. We don't see people, we don't see Christians, we don't see Mennonites, we don't see Bible-believing people walking around with a literal yoke on their neck. So we all agree it's a spiritual yoke. But even so, if you protest and say that Christian liberty means that I don't need this yoke on me, I would like you to consider that as human beings, we're not a spiritual entity in ourselves. We will accept and also promote the yoke or the doctrine of ultimately one of two distinct kingdoms, either God or the devil. And so we don't say that we have the yoke of Keith Weaver or we have the yoke of David Kaufman. No, it's because the yoke we take on us is referring to a doctrine, and all doctrine ultimately leads to two distinct kingdoms, God and the devil. And so you will, in some way, wear some type of yoke in a spiritual sense. I'll give you some alternative choices. Would you like to trade the Christian yoke for addictions? Would you like to trade it for perverted appetites? Would you like to trade it for depression? Or would you like to trade it for emotional instability? Or what about witchcraft? Which of these would you trade your Christian experience for? You know, sometimes it does us good to actually stop and consider, well, so if I don't like what is offered me, what is the alternative? Would you truly trade your devotions for addictions? Would you really trade your faith for depression? And I'm not trying to get into the weeds with this one, but just take it at simple face value. Would you really trade your faith for depression? Would you really trade hope for suicide? Which yoke really is lighter? Which yoke really is easier? But you say, oh, I won't have to go to such extremes. Oh, really? You are not the epitome of doctrine. We technically don't choose our yoke. We only choose our master and accept the type of yoke that he puts upon us. And so I'd like to say that taking Jesus' yoke this morning could be summarized in three simple steps. Number one, surrender. Jesus is offering this yoke. There's no question in our minds it's the best option. It's lighter, it's easier, but you will need to surrender. Are you going to stick your neck through the yoke? Secondly, it's going to take faith. Do you believe the master has your best interest at heart? And thirdly, it's going to take obedience. Are you willing to move forward in step with him? The third part of the message, I'd like to take Jesus' words when he says, and learn of me. And I'd like you to turn to Mark chapter 6. I think I'll just read a few verses here in Mark chapter 6, starting at verse 1. Thinking of learning of Christ, keep that in mind as we read some of these verses. And he went out from thence and came into his own country, and his disciples followed him. And when the Sabbath day was come, he began to teach in the synagogue. For many hearing him were astonished, saying, From whence hath this man these things? And what wisdom is this which is given unto him, that even such mighty works are wrought by his hands? Is not this the carpenter, the son of Mary, the brother of James and Joses, of Judah and Simon? And are not his sisters here with us? And they were offended at him. But Jesus said unto them, A prophet is not without honor, but in his own country, and among his own kin, and in his own house. And he could there do no mighty works, save that he laid his hands upon a few sick folk and healed them. And he marveled because of their unbelief, and he went round about the villages teaching. I'd just like to stop there. In verse 4, he uses a double negative where he says a prophet is not without honor, but in his own country. In reality, he's saying a prophet doesn't have honor except outside of his own country. And so the disciples are following him, and he's in his own hometown, home area, and he's not able to do many, what does it say, many mighty works because of their unbelief. I like to picture the disciples following Jesus and maybe some of the questions that this was starting to bring on their minds, like what's going on? Jesus' own hometown, he healed a few sick folk, it says, but other than that, he was unable to perform. And then in verse 14 to 29, Jesus then, he divided up his 12 disciples in verse 7, and he sends them out two by two. He gives them power over unclean spirits. He goes on to say, take no staff, no bread, no money. And so the disciples split up and go out two by two. Verse 13, and they cast out many devils and anointed with oil many that were sick and healed them. And then we go on to the death of John the Baptist, and comparing it with the account in Matthew, it seems like this took place over the same period of time. And I think we know the story. It's not going to go into the story real deeply there with John the Baptist, but I'd like you to look at verse 30 now. In verse 30, and the apostles gathered themselves together unto Jesus and told him all things, both what they had done and what they had taught. Somehow to me, I gather a mixed bag of feelings there as they come to Jesus and they sit down and they converse and rehearse what all they had done, what all they had seen, what all they had accomplished. And this was all with the backdrop of Jesus' own hometown rejecting him, and they're not accepting him. Therefore, they were not able to do many mighty works there. And also in the back of their minds was this beheading of John the Baptist. And to me, it seems like there was no doubt that there was some exhaustion here with the disciples. Yes, they had their... They obviously had some success, but there was also, I think, probably a lot that weighed on them, and that was laying on their minds, on their hearts. You know, here they were, they had given up all they had to follow Jesus, and there was definitely times of stress and worry and care. But I'd like now to read verse 30 through verse 46. The apostles gathered themselves together unto Jesus and told him all things, both what they had done and what they had taught. And he said unto them, Come ye apart and rest a while, or come ye yourselves apart into a desert place and rest a while. For there were many coming and going, and they had no leisure so much as to eat. And they departed into a desert place by ship privately. And the people saw them departing, and many knew him, and ran afoot thither out of the cities, and outwent them, and came together unto him. And Jesus, when he came out, saw much people, and was moved with compassion toward them, because they were as sheep not having a shepherd. And he began to teach them many things. And when the day was now far spent, the disciples came unto him and said, This is a desert place, and now the time is far past. Send them away, that they may go out into the country round about and into the villages and buy themselves bread, for they have nothing to eat. And he answered and said unto them, Give ye them to eat. And they say unto him, Shall we go and buy 200 pennies worth of bread and give them to eat? He saith unto them, How many loaves have ye? Go and see. And when they knew, they say, 5 and 2 fishes. He commanded them to make all sit down by companies upon the green grass. And they sat down in ranks by hundreds and by fifties. And when he had taken the 5 loaves and the 2 fishes, he looked up to heaven and blessed and brake the loaves and gave them to his disciples to set before them. And the 2 fishes he divided among all. And they did all eat and were filled. And they took up 12 basketfuls of fragments and of the fishes. And they that did eat of the loaves were about 5,000 men. And straightway he constrained his disciples to get into a ship and go to the other side before unto Bethsaida, while he sent away the people. And when he had sent them away, he departed into a mountain to pray. I'm just going to leave off reading there. I'd like to pull out 3 things here, thinking of learning of Christ. What do we learn of Christ as far as finding rest? The first one I take from verse 31, where Jesus says, Come ye yourselves apart into a desert place and rest a while. For there were many coming and going, and they had no leisure so much as to eat. No doubt these disciples were already exhausted by all they had been through. And Jesus here, what we learn, the first thing I have that we learn of Christ is that he sought rest, but prioritized compassion and service. So the disciples could have responded numerous ways here in their situation. They could have posed as invincible. They could have pretended that they weren't wore out, tired. But Jesus saw this in them, and they were fairly free, in my own opinion, with how they felt. But Jesus, he told them to come and to rest, and then the people saw what was happening, and they outran him. And when they when Jesus got there, he sees the people, and instead of going and resting, he turns and begins to teach again. And to me, it would have been likely almost discouraging for the disciples. You know, here was Jesus, he had promised them rest, and now he's prioritizing service. He's asking them to we'll get to that in the next part. But they needed to follow Jesus' example in ministering to the people. It is not a Christian virtue to pose as invincible, nor is it admirable to pretend you're unaffected by your inhumanity. You are not a loser to admit exhaustion. Being objective with the reality of our condition is the first step to success. I'd like, in the second place, to look at Jesus' example in verse 35. So the disciples come to him, and Jesus is there teaching, and they appear to be hungry themselves. It says in verse 31, they had no leisure so much as to eat. And then the day's coming to an end. There's thousands of people, and the disciples suggest to Jesus that just send them away. It's time for them to leave. The day is far past. They're on their own now. We're done ministering to these people. Jesus showed that rest and revival was found in answering the call to labor, not in escaping it. And we maybe touched on this a little bit before. Just try to imagine the disciples' exasperation at Jesus' answer to their suggestion. After they had labored so long and so hard, almost no time to eat, almost no privacy, Jesus is saying now, he's saying, you go and give them something to eat. Furthermore, they had to go and find the food. They had to place the people in companies. And then Jesus says, when he takes the loaves and he gives the bread, he says, now you take it and you feed it to the people. How many times in our own experience do we want to have our own time? We want to feed our own face. But Jesus' example here that we want to learn from is that the way to rest and revival is found in answering the call to labor, not in escaping it. This is a bit of fictional fantasy on my own part, but how many basketfuls were left over? And they took up 12 basketfuls of fragments and of the fishes. And I had to wonder, what happened to those 12 basketfuls of leftover food? The Bible doesn't tell us, so I guess it's up to your imagination, but 12 baskets of food, 12 disciples. Is there any chance Jesus would have given a basket of food to each of the disciples? I'd like you to consider what happens in verse 45. After they had all eaten and they had gathered up the fragments, I think Jesus, understanding the disciples' exhaustion, it says, and straightway he constrained his disciples to get into the ship and go to the other side before into Bethsaida, while he sent the people away. Somehow this is the kind of master that I want to be yoked with. Someone that understands my needs. Someone that just doesn't give me what I want all the time. But no doubt in the end will supply me with the grace and strength I need to follow him. In verse 46, yet Jesus found rest in prayer and communion with the Father. And when he had sent them away, he departed into a mountain to pray. It's the third thing I have listed here in learning of Christ. He found rest in prayer and communion with the Father. Matthew 14:23, this same story in Matthew's account. And when he had sent the multitudes away, he went up into a mountain apart to pray. And when the evening was come, he was there alone. Mark 1:35, and in the morning, rising up a great while before day, he went out and departed into a solitary place and prayed. Luke 5:16, and he withdrew himself into the wilderness and prayed. And it's almost without fail when you find Jesus in the scripture by himself, he's usually praying. Prayer is not just work, it's a method of release, it's a measure of rest. Prayer is not just work, it's a method of release, it's a measure of rest. Some of you may have seen this saying already, that prayer is taking your troubles to God, faith is leaving them there. And so when you enter into your prayer closet, per se, there's a burden on your back, there's a burden on your heart. But if you take your troubles to God in prayer and faith is leaving them there, you'll exit that prayer closet with a change in your appearance. You will come out a changed man. There is something you left behind in that closet. Oh, what peace we often forfeit. Oh, what needless pain we bear, all because we do not carry everything to God in prayer. Are we weak and heavy laden, cumbered with a load of care? Precious Savior, still our yoke fellow, take it to the Lord in prayer. In the last part here of the message, I'd like to just notice a few kinds of rest, and we don't have time to turn to some of these references. But the three kinds of rest in the scriptures would be physical rest, soul rest, and spiritual rest. And we could turn back to Genesis, and there's verses throughout the Psalms that refer to the creation of night as a time to rest physically. I think it's the one verse in Psalms 127 where he says, he talks about building the house, and he says, it is vain for you to sit up, to rise up early, to sit up late, to eat the bread of, I forget how it goes, but the thought there, I'm not going to turn to it, but the thought there of vain is ruinous. It's ruinous to your health. To not allow the use of the created nighttime for physical rest. Physical rest is also provided for in the creation and sanctification of the Sabbath observance. And we could turn to Genesis 2 and Mark 2, where in Mark's account is where the Pharisees found fault with Jesus' disciples in plucking corn on the Sabbath day. And Jesus said there in that account that the Sabbath was created for man, not man for the Sabbath. And so we have God providing avenues of physical rest for us as human beings. I'd like you to turn to Hebrews chapter 4. There's a few verses I want to read here regarding soul rest. We find soul rest in salvation. And in Hebrews 4, he's referring to, well, actually chapter 3 and 4. The Christian rest here is portrayed by the Israelites taking possession of the land of Canaan. The guilt of sin is compared to Israel's captivity among the nations. And then Christian rest is compared to possessing the land of Canaan. And here in Hebrews verse 4, I'm just going to read a few verses, starting at verse 1. Let us therefore fear, lest a promise being left us of entering into his rest, any of you should seem to come short of it. For unto us was the gospel preached as well as unto them, but the word preached did not profit them, not being mixed with faith in them that heard it. For we which have believed do enter into rest, as he said, as I have sworn in my wrath, if they shall enter into my rest, although the works were finished from the foundation of the world. For he spake in a certain place of the seventh day on this wise, and God did rest the seventh day from all his works. And in this place again, if they shall enter into my rest, seeing therefore it remaineth that some must enter therein, and they to whom it was first preached entered not in because of unbelief. Again, he limiteth a certain day, saying in David, today, after so long a time, as it is said, today if you will hear his voice, harden not your hearts. For if Jesus or Joshua had given them rest, then would he not afterward have spoken of another day? There remaineth therefore a rest to the people of God. For he that is entered into his rest, he also hath ceased from his own works as God did from his. Let us therefore labor, therefore, to enter into that rest, lest any man fall after the same example of unbelief. And we don't have time to go into this very deeply, but I'd just like to point out again how unbelief is not the avenue for rest. It's faith. Faith in God and in the work on the cross that he's done for us. The salvation brings soul rest. And then one verse yet in Revelation 14, thinking of eternal rest or spiritual rest. And I know we use soul and spirit interchangeably, but the spirit, I think there's a sense where as long as time continues, there's not a true rest in the spirit. There's a battle to be fought. In Revelation 14, verse 13, we have this voice from heaven saying unto me, write, blessed are the dead which die in the Lord. Henceforth, yea, saith the Spirit, that they may rest from their labors and their works do follow them. There's something within us as mortal beings here in this world that craves rest. If you would turn back to Luke chapter 12, the account of the rich man, when he said that he was going to pull down his barns and build greater, he said he's going to take his ease, eat, drink, and be merry. And ease there is the same word as rest. That rich man was craving rest. He wanted to lay up a store for himself so that he could just finally be at rest. But that's not what he found. He actually found the opposite. But here in Revelation 14, this voice from heaven says that if you die in the Lord, then you can rest from your labors. And I'd like to highlight that. If dying in the Lord, only a successful finish, Only a going till you're gone is going to guarantee true eternal rest. Let's kneel for prayer.